You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
If you think they're going to give you your country back without a fight, you are sadly mistaken. Every day it is going to be a fight, and that is what I'm proudest about Donald Trump.
Trump's chief strategist Steve Bannon emboldens America's white nationalists, but has he turned on those very people who brought him to office? My guests, James Rogers and Sebastian Borgia, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including how refugees might have found an alternative route from the Mediterranean, why the world seems to trust Vladimir Putin more than Trump when it comes to foreign policy, and why Zimbabwe's First Lady has asked for diplomatic immunity. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed James Rogers and Sebastian Borgia. James Rogers is the head of international journalism studies at City University London, and Sebastian's the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to Midori House. Now, just before we came on air, news broke that a van had ploughed into crowds in Barcelona's city centre. Many are feared dead and injured, as this happened in Las Ramblas area, boulevard, of course, popular with tourists. We're going to cross over to Spain to get the latest from our correspondent in the country, Liam Aldous. Liam, good afternoon to you. Perhaps you can bring us up to date on the latest. What more do we know about the nature of the attack and its immediate consequences?
Well, the fatality count seems to be rising by the second. Police sources have actually confirmed 13 fatalities and around 20 people injured. Reports and the images coming out of Barcelona show that a van entered the La Rambla at the peak time of the day from Plaza Catalunya and rammed down a stretch, about 530-meter stretch, plowing into dozens of people. And two of the suspects are reported to have fled from the van and are now holed up in a nearby bar. The police are saying this isn't a hostage situation as yet, but lots of images coming out of Barcelona show armed police going street by street looking for other suspects. There's also reports of a second van, and police have actually released the registration number of this van, so they're treating it as a terrorist attack as we speak.
And an ongoing attack at that, Liam. And of course, we should point out Spain, without prejudging the cause or the aggressors here. Spain is a country that's familiar with attacks from, for example, Islamic extremists, fundamentalists, and this attack appears certainly at first sight to bear the hallmarks of recent attacks in other European and other urban centres.
Yes, it does. And it shows that the professionalism of the police was evident within just a few minutes of the attack. They cordoned off the area, all the metro stations and train stations in a very large radius have actually been shut down. And the police have warned all outsiders to stay at home, and also all people living there to stay at home, and all outsiders to stay away from the area as we speak. So I'm sure there'll be further developments in the coming minutes.
Indeed. Liam, thanks for bringing us up to date. That's our Spain correspondent, Liam Aldous. It's a breaking story, of course. We'll have more updates on Monocle 24 throughout the evening from Liam and from Barcelona as well. Let's continue with the show. But James Rogers and Sebastian Borgia, welcome. And James, just to pick up before we move on with what we're hearing, obviously the situation, as Liam explained, mm-hmm. they're rather unclear. But again, it strikes us, we've had these conversations before, it seems the new normal, and it only really serves to remind how little cities, even very well prepared cities, can do to really address this kind of possibility.
It's true. I mean, I think if one can put it this way, in a way it's slightly surprising that we've come this far into the European tourist season, August, when many people in Western Europe go on holiday, before something of this nature has happened. And you're absolutely right, Tom, it is impossible. The only societies in history which have prevented or at least contained terror to a great extent have been police states, and that's not something which would be politically acceptable. But in order to allow people to go about their business, it is impossible to make a modern city centre entirely secure.
And Sebastian, just a word from you briefly, obviously, again, to repeat the idea that this is a very much a breaking news story. It's moving quickly. There is something grimly, perhaps, predictable about this. We've talked about attacks here in the UK, of course, in France, in Germany, wherever we look, certainly in Western Europe, nowhere seems to be immune. And now it appears this kind of terror has returned again, sadly, to Spain.
I was in Florence the week before last, and you know, one of those tens of thousands of tourists walking through that beautiful place. And to be honest, I mean, I was occasionally slightly concerned by the lack of preparation. And I have to say, I mean, however professional the Spanish police reacted to the attack, I can't quite understand how a lorry, a big van, can be allowed to enter a place like Las Ramblas. But there we are. That's maybe because, you know, we had exactly the same thing in Berlin, of course. You know, Nice had happened in July of last year. The Berlin police had 5 months to prepare for something like that and didn't. And the access to the Christmas market where then people were killed was totally free for big lorry. I have to say, sorry, that's the kind of thing that I think police authorities all over Europe should by now have anticipated.
Indeed. It's a grim story. We will return to it later on Monocle 24, but for now on Midori House. Let's move on. Let's head to the United States. President Donald Trump is facing the consequences of his remarks on the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend. First came resignations from his manufacturing council, and then yesterday, following several more departures by various captains of industry, seemingly bewildered by Trump's recent press conferences, he announced that he'd disbanded entirely both the manufacturing council and his strategic and policy forum. To top that, in the meantime, the White House's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, from whom we heard at the top of the program, attacked the American far right as clowns, contradicting his boss, of course, Donald Trump. James, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. We've seen the sort of weird anti-logic of Trump before, welcoming decisions that seem to go against things he said by finding silver linings in the clouds. We shouldn't be surprised, but there's the sheer brass neck, the bravura with which he announced that, in fact, he was disbanding these things, and it was perfectly fine to him that all these CEOs who he had professed to be very close to were leaving anyway. Surely he's sort of running out of options in terms of trying to claim the moral high ground.
I think running out is a very relevant phrase here, actually, because Mr. Trump may have gained 12, 24 hours of satisfaction by the fact that he said, OK, before you leave, I'm going to sack you anyway. But if you think about the way that this is starting to unfold, why do people serve on presidential committees on things like this? They serve on it because they think it's going to do their business good, because they think it's going to do their standing in the community good. And when people come towards the end of their terms in office, or when people become unpopular, then business leaders may choose to distance themselves from politicians. But let's not forget, this is happening less than 9 months after Mr. Trump took the oath of office. And this is really, you know, the kind of actions you might expect from prominent business leaders. And Mr. Trump, of course, his career thus far has been exclusively in business and not in politics or the military, a point which has frequently been made. And yet business leaders are distancing themselves from him. They're already saying to themselves, maybe Mr. Trump has got the best part of another 4 years to go, but we don't want to be part of it.
And Sebastian, that's an interesting point, isn't it, that James raises there. Trump made much fanfare initially that he was a deal maker, then failed to do the big deal on healthcare that he had pledged to address immediately. He then changed tack and said, I'm still the great businessman. Business leaders, as James puts out, are leaving en bloc. It almost doesn't matter, does it, whether those business leaders quit out of a point of principle or whether it's because they're worried about the bottom line. The key fact is it shows that Trump has alienated another section of the community that he supposedly understood well.
And a segment of society which was quite happy to come to his aid and fill all the spaces on his business advisory panels. Yes, absolutely right. I just wonder whether it actually matters. You know, his base seems peculiarly unperturbed by all of this. The base, you have to remember, of course, are people who are extremely distrustful of big business in the first place, who may tend to have rather conservative views as far
that was
as
very, that was very delicately put.
As far as race and identity politics is concerned. As long as this base seems to stick with Trump, I think we'll have to sit here and listen to his pronouncements as we have for the last half year.
And James, that's an interesting point that Sebastian makes there. And does this in some respects explain why there appears to now be a divergence even between Trump and Bannon? Bannon, of course, formerly of Breitbart News, a real rabble-rouser, a quite pronounced right-winger to the point, certainly, of white nationalism. He's now reined back himself, seemingly criticising the US far-right in a way that doesn't sit very comfortably with Trump's most recent comments. Is this the problem, that Trump ultimately is appealing, exactly as Sebastian said, to this core vote, and he's going to be practically the only person left, even outside Bannon, who won't condemn these people who really should only ever be on the margins of the US
society?
Yeah,
but I mean, I think Sebastian makes a very good point. It's quite hard to see, at least in the short term, how this is really going to cost Mr. Trump practically in political terms. I mean, in terms of impeachment, which of course has been talked about, the numbers don't stack up for that at the moment. They may do if we see, for example, as we did yesterday, the very unusual spectacle of the two previous presidents Bush coming out to condemn what they'd seen.
But they didn't vote for him in the first place.
They didn't vote for him in the first place, but it is a reminder to the party establishment that they should be distancing themselves, I think. And if we think how little President George W. Bush has said in public since leaving office, I was quite struck by that yesterday, actually, especially by the show of unity between two very senior figures. But you're right, Sebastian, they didn't endorse him in the first place. But I think you are also right to point out that, you know, most of his support probably don't care, and I think Mr. Trump is probably quite safe in playing on that. As far as Mr. Bannon goes, of course, with all these rumours that his job may not be safe, Mr. Trump has refused to give him public backing when pointedly asked to do so recently. But I think it comes back to the thing we've seen right throughout the Trump presidency so far, brief as it's been, it's hard to imagine, but Mr. Trump is in some ways bringing across skills which he acquired in a successful business career, some of which translate quite well to politics and diplomacy, others of which don't translate well at all.
And what about where we should look, Sebastian, for relief from this picture? It's interesting. Some people have said, hang, you know, now's the time for the Democrats to make their move. They may be weakened in terms of the political balance at the moment, with both houses, etc., against them, but surely the perfect time to strike. Is the more trenchant point here, when is the time for the GOP to get its act together? You know, it's interesting, exactly as James said there, a couple of grandees coming out. It's quite striking to see that. Trump, in the last few days, with these pronouncements over Charlottesville, appears to have offended even some pretty right-wing Republicans. You know, you've got Tea Party plus right-wingers saying, well, hang on, he's not speaking for me. He can ill afford, surely, to do that.
I wish you were right. I'm more pessimistic.
I'm pretty pessimistic, so this worries me a great deal.
I haven't, for the last half year, seen or heard any interesting comment from a Democrat. Sorry, none, nothing. All they do is be outraged. That's great for their base. It doesn't convince anybody on the other side. It doesn't move the from our perspective, much too far equilibrium of the United States further to the center, as far as I can see. And as and when you look at the Republicans, well, you know, there's the usual suspects, Senators Graham and McCain and people like that. That's fine, but as far as it goes, he hasn't achieved. I mean, that's the interesting thing. He hasn't achieved anything, Trump. You know, but he hasn't. I can't see him changing tack until the opinion polls, or indeed by election and election results, go against him.
And given the character traits that he continues, James, to demonstrate, is it more likely that in the end, I mean, this is slightly wild speculation, that he'll lose patience and, you know, he'll throw the toys out the pram and say, I'm walking away, you know.
Which everyone toys? Said, everyone he's said thrown them all out anyway.
I suppose it's possible, but I mean, I think I can't really foresee that at the moment. I think, you know, Mr. Trump is determined to do at least 4 years, and some American friends and colleagues I talked to suggest he might try eight. I mean, I think that would certainly try his patience, if not the patience of the United States electorate too.
Sobering thoughts. And just on that point about the Democrats, I mean, it's interesting what Sebastian was saying there, but to a degree, are the Democrats right to maybe just keep a low profile and say, to be honest, that we can't say anything that reshapes this landscape? Let's just leave this show going. And, you know, in a sense, Trump's doing more damage in the name of the Democrat cause than any Democrat could do at the moment by saying anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Firstly, the Democrats aren't really in a position just at the moment or in the short term to actually affect any change. And I share Sebastian's view that actually they haven't really got very much to say for themselves. You know, this is a time for them, one would imagine, strategically to start to formulate policy for when those opportunities at the ballot box do present themselves.
Well, let's move off at a slight tangent to this discussion. Who would you trust more to lead the world in foreign policy terms, Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin? According to Pew Research Center's 2017 spring survey, the majority of people in 22 countries seems to prefer the Russian leader. Sebastian, perhaps not what one might have expected, although given the conversation we've just had, maybe less surprising certainly than it would have been, say, 12 months ago. Can I ask, who would Sebastian Borger choose?
Well, look, I've got an easy task here. I just stick with my Chancellor Angela Merkel, and leave the boys to fishing in Siberia and playing golf in Florida. I mean, to be fair, of course, it's not actually a majority of people. It's just a few more people trust Putin than Trump, but
are we talking about least worst options?
Yes, exactly. And I certainly wouldn't trust Vladimir Putin one inch. We've just had a very interesting discussion in Germany. Again, you know, we've had it basically since the annexation of Crimea, about how to relate to Russia, and we've got one of the smaller party leaders saying we need to just put Crimea to one side and get on with Russia, and of course the Chancellor, having grown up under Russian occupation in East Germany, is of a rather different view. No. I mean, he's what he is, I think. James will know much better, having lived in Moscow. What he is, he's, I think we can work him out more. I think I know roughly where he's coming from, whereas Trump constantly comes round a corner which I didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what people reflect.
And James, that's a very good point, isn't it? And I'd be interested to pick your brain as a former Moscow resident. There is something to that, isn't there? We may not like his politics, his persona, his agenda, Putin, but he's a politician of sorts. And he at least seems to have an understanding of the consequences of his actions. He seems to have an understanding of history too, because he's actually been reasonably good at knowing when to tweak the nose of adversaries or allies alike. In a sense, that does set him apart from Trump, who remains entirely unpredictable, as Sebastian describes.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mr. Putin's supporters, and they remain quite many in Russia, and they, you know, they do exist in other countries in the world, as this research tends to suggest. His supporters would say that he is strong and stable, as a phrase now discredited in British politics. But I think, having watched him, his rise initially coming to prime minister and then becoming president in Russia. One thing I would say about Mr. Putin is, whatever one thinks of him, one has to pay tribute to his tremendous skills as a politician. He is very versatile. He knows his constituency extremely well. He can be the tough guy fishing in Siberia. He can be the head of state receiving economic advisers in the gilded halls of the Kremlin. And he can go and talk to soldiers in their own rough language and you know, be one of the lads as well. So he's very, very, very skilled at that. But his critics would also say that while, yes, he's very good tactically, he knows when to do things and when not to, strategically it's a little hard to see how Russian history would judge Mr. Putin. After all, you know, he presided over this massive economic boom fueled by oil prices in the last decade. Russia's prospects now are a little less clear.
Indeed. Now, we began the programme, of course, in Barcelona, and we return to Spain now. A slightly different story. The Spanish Coast Guard says it's rescued around 600 migrants crossing from Morocco in a single 24-hour period. According to estimates, at this rate, Spain could overtake Greece this year in terms of the number of migrants arriving by sea. Now Sebastian, we've talked on a number of occasions over the last couple of years about the Mediterranean migrant crisis, about these movements of people. We're seeing seemingly a spike in a slightly different area. Is this suggesting that other operations, maybe elsewhere in the Mediterranean, are working?
Well, I maybe it's a little bit early for that, but it could, of course, be that the change of tack by the Italian Coast Guard, which has been much tougher on these, in my view, rather irresponsible organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières, who have encouraged the dirty business of people smuggling over the Mediterranean. The much tougher tactic of the Coast Guard is bearing fruit. There have been fewer people coming across to Italy in the last 2 weeks. But of course, if that now means that the people smugglers move from Libya further west into what we so far thought was a stable state, Morocco, which could deal with that kind of a crime, then we are having to rethink our strategy, I suppose.
And it's interesting, isn't it, James? I mean, the numbers are quite striking. The United Nations says more than 9,000 people have arrived in Spain this way this year, three times as many just as 2016. I mean, again, can Spain and can these various other instruments that have been looking maybe more to the east previously, I mean, can they cope with that sort of uptick in numbers?
Well, it doesn't look like it from the media reports that we're getting from there. It does look like it's putting a strain on resources. But one thing that does seem to be certain to say, however, if numbers can be contained or reduced by whatever means and for whatever reasons, it does seem that this is something which is now becoming an annual occurrence in the Mediterranean. Mm. I mean, from the reports that I've seen about this, it does tend to suggest that many of the people who are making the crossing at the moment are more in the category of economic migrants rather than refugees. But of course, this is very frequently a difficult distinction to make, and there are many people who would fall into both categories in that sense. But it seems that from the origins of the people who are making the crossing, that they seem to be coming from countries which don't have hot conflicts, as we might say, like, for example, Syria. But nevertheless, it seems to be, there are established numbers of people who are going to try to make the crossing, and if one route is closed, then substantial numbers of them, perhaps aided by people smugglers, are going to try to make another crossing point.
Sebastian, can I ask you, because we talked before a number of months ahead of the German elections about what a hot topic this remains, certainly for Angela Merkel, and her issues with this are well documented. Is it still as feisty a political, is it still as hot a political potato as it was then? And what's the narrative? And do you think it will change if we see changes, for example, to the paths that particular groups of these very vulnerable people are taking towards the European mainland?
She felt strong enough last weekend or last week, I can't remember, to actually suggest that Germany might have to take more refugees again in future. So I think, as far as she is concerned at the moment, it's an issue that has been dealt with. And that, there is still a groundswell of support for taking on genuine refugees and trying to integrate them, if at the same time the country is able to reject those who come for economic reasons, and also to throw out those who have clearly come in under false pretenses. I think that was the problem that a lot of people had with her initial policy two years ago. As long as that is still the case, I think people are willing to listen to her and to take on more genuine refugees. But of course, if you look at the list of countries, as James has pointed out, who've come across the Mediterranean, Nigeria, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Bangladesh. And, you know, people look at that kind of the list and say, well, sorry, you know, understandably looking for a better life, but not fleeing a civil war as Syrians were 2 years ago and still are.
And James, that's interesting to reflect on what Sebastian says there, particularly if we look at Angela Merkel. Is part of the reason that her hand strengthens on this because politically she's in a better position than she was certainly a few months ago. Fewer questions asked. She looks to have a pretty robust September performance ahead of her. Is that more important than fixing the actual problem? It's more important to make sure you fix the domestic politics, or is that, I don't know, is that not relevant here?
No, I mean, I think she obviously does feel that her prospects for the election are very good, which is why she feels confident enough to go on to territory which has previously caused her to be questioned and has, you know, raised wider questions in German society. As Sebastian has suggested, she obviously feels that this has been dealt with for the time being, so she feels that she is in a strong enough position to raise the subject again, and that has to be the sign of a very confident politician so close to an election.
We're going to end the day's programme with a bit of a lighter discussion about diplomatic immunity. Now, currently South Africa's debating whether to grant diplomatic immunity to Zimbabwe's First Lady, Grace Mugabe, who's accused of assaulting a model in Johannesburg last week. There's been quite a lot of speculation about her whereabouts following the incident. Sebastian, obviously there's some big personalities involved here. What do you make of this story? It does seem, at least to my cynical eyes, that Mrs. Mugabe's bid for diplomatic immunity could perhaps be related to this alleged incident. Too cynical, or could there be something to that?
I couldn't possibly comment on the level of your cynicism, but of course the examples of high-ranking family members of dodgy presidents and heads of state are legendary, aren't they? I mean, I have, apart from Berliner Zeitung, the honor to write for a number of Swiss papers, and of course, the Swiss about 10 years ago had that fascinating incident with the son of Colonel Gaddafi in Geneva, where the police in Geneva, as is their due and their task, split up a domestic violence incident, the perpetrator of which was Mr. Annibal Gaddafi, and got into very, very hot water because they actually put him in a jail cell for a night, which then took, and the irate father back in Libya then took two Swiss business people hostage, despite the Swiss president apologizing. We had a very similar incident here in London, you may remember, in Claridge's, where he was beating up his wife, and the British police was cleverer. They waited until the Libyan general turned up and could tell them that Hannibal, of course, had diplomatic immunity. It's a very sorry business, isn't it? But you know, there's nothing in the end you can do.
Well, possibly not. I just wondered, James, just briefly, I mean, how much malfeasance goes on within the sort of diplomatic bag? I remember the story of a former Nigerian minister who himself was basically, well, they tried to sort of repatriate him in said diplomatic bag, and he was just about rescued by an eagle-eyed British customs officer who said, well, hang on, I think that bag should be on the manifest. How much malfeasance goes on? Or again, am I simply being too cynical?
I think some does. I mean, there are quite public rows as well, and you might remember the United States Embassy here in London had a big row with the London authorities when they introduced the charge known as the congestion charge here, which listeners may know was placed to try to reduce traffic in the city centre.
I think there's still a number
still
of...
Not ten,
it's about 100 million quid.
I think it may still be going on.
The
exactly,
mayor of London called the ambassador a chiselling little crook.
Dear me.
I hope he had diplomatic immunity from the libel courts for that one.
Yeah, there's surely no cause for that sort of language. Well, maybe we just have to... I worry we've struck a cynical note, but no, we've tackled it with some levity. Who knows? I'm sure that all the diplomats are very well behaved in point of fact. That brings us to the end of today's programme. My thanks to both James Rogers and Sebastian Borger for joining me on Midori House. That's all for the show, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My thanks to all of them. More music for you at 1900. I'll be back with more news. The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck follows, and there'll be more on the day's main stories, including, of course, the ongoing breaking news out of Barcelona in Spain on the Monocle Daily at 2200. We'll have more news, though, at the top of each hour before then to keep you up to date. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.